Sportsnet 650, Vancouver.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance live from the Kintech Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Harmon Dial will join us at 1, but we got an open segment here and more time to kind of expand and dive into a lot of what we heard from Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin earlier today at Rogers Arena. And there's a couple of things about how the team's going to handle the offseason, what they're looking to add, their philosophy on that I do want to get into. But on the Elias Pettersson discussion, and we hit it quickly in the whiteboard, right, where it was, yes, a vote of confidence, but also some major reservations, leaving options open, all of that with Elias Pettersson. And even beyond that, and I made this point, there was kind of a new layer to either the criticism or the diagnosis or whatever, the discourse around Elias Pettersson coming from team management. Because we've heard, obviously, at this point, a lot about preparation, what he's doing in the summer, practice habits, all those sorts of things, and improving those as a means to fixing whatever has ailed him for the past 14, 15 months now of his NHL playing career. And we heard more of that, right? We heard more of, hey, you know, we want him to stay here. Hey, he's been in the gym a couple times already for us here today. We hope he's going to do more of that. But we also heard from Jim Rutherford the idea that he needs to buy in, not just to working hard and preparing himself and getting stronger and all that, but he needs to buy in to be more of a complete player. And Jim Rutherford said, you know, look, he's always going to be able to get his points, which, again, was not really the case this year or last year down the stretch and into the playoffs. But you can't win with your top player just getting points. He has to buy in on working hard. He has to buy in on being a complete player. And he told, you know, kind of one of the all-time favorite old hockey guy stories of Scotty Bowman convincing Steve Yzerman to sacrifice offense for defense and that leading to Stanley Cup victories in Detroit. He shared his experience with Sidney Crosby and Mike Sullivan in a similar transition, he thought, for Sidney Crosby, and suggested that that's something that needs to happen with Elias Pettersson. But the interesting thing is, I don't know that we've ever looked at like Elias Pettersson as this kind of unserious offense-only player. Like, that line of criticism almost sounded more like what Connor Bedard's hearing this year in Chicago, or maybe like Jack Eichel when he was in Buffalo or something, right? Where it's this idea like, oh, he's flashy and he puts up points, but, you know, he doesn't actually, you're not actually winning his minutes because he's so bad defensively or whatever. Like, that hasn't been Elias Pettersson's calling card as an NHL player, either when he's been at his best or when he's been at his lowest, right? If there was one thing you could hang your hat on for Elias Pettersson this year, it was he's doing an all right job defensively. And so I found that.
I guess, man. People sure. have always been way.
Sure.
People have always. You know me. I've been fading the Selke talk.
Yeah.
For a long, long time. Like, there is more to defense than driving play. There are players who, like, Dylan Holloway is a really good example. Dylan Holloway has some of the best defensive metrics of any NHL forward this season. But when you watch him in his own end, there are, you know, not hiccups, because he's got this, like, he's going to be a plus defensive winger. I just don't think he actually is yet, but he has great defense. Why? Because the Blues always have the puck when he's on the ice. He transitions, he drives play in other ways, and so it's hard to generate shots and scoring chances against when he's on the ice. But that might mean that he makes defensive impact, just like Pettersson has throughout his career, but he's not doing it with defense.
Sure.
He's doing it with...
But I think there's been moments in Pettersson's career where it's been more than that, like what you're describing with Dylan Holloway.
For sure, but there's, you know, also been moments where he's consistently, where he's way too easy to push off the puck.
For sure. But I guess what I'm getting at here
is if you
look at...
There's never been moments, whether his coach was Travis Green, Bruce Boudreau, or Rick Tocchet, where he was counted on to play a matchup role.
That's true.
Like, you know, the truth is, is that the Selke talk, the Datsyuk comparisons, like, was always way too far ahead of its skis. Always.
But the thing is, if you're looking at the last 14 or 15 months, it's like, I think if you were the Canucks, you would kill to have Pettersson, like, putting up a loosey-goosey 100 points.
Oh,
you know
no
what
kidding.
I mean? It's like, that's agreed. The issue. The issue agreed. Is he's not a game breaker. And it's like, it would be so much easier. The problem would be so much easier if it was like, wow, we got this guy. He's electric with the puck. He can,
yeah, he just
he
needs
can
to rein it
defenses,
in.
But he just needs to pay more attention to the details.
100%.
That's not the issue.
No, the
that's
issue
not
is
the issue.
The issue is zero juice.
Yeah. And it's like, you, I think your point about, well, he's not really a Selke guy is totally fair, but he's not like a liability.
No.
He shouldn't be.
Well,
you know what I mean? Where it's like, ooh, I don't know if we can win with that defensive effort from our elite offensive center. It's like, you can. You just need him to be that elite offensive center.
Well, I also think when he left the lineup as a result of that late season injury, you could see how much more permissive the team got defensively.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they really struggled to handle, and this is sort of what we talked about during the Four Nations. It's like, Pettersson can still hit or catch up to a top of the lineup type pace. Like, he can keep up with that pace. He's just not explosive in those minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real problem, because you need him to be the reason you win those minutes the way he has been, you know, for large stretches of his career. But yeah, I mean, the strength thing, winning puck battles that don't involve throwing a reverse hit,
mm-hmm.
right? Just being able to, like, use a cross check to your back to propel you forward and gain space. The core strength thing, because that's associated with explosiveness of your stride. I mean, he's grown in, like, he's a much bigger guy. I as much as, like, the work rate, the preparation side has been talked about a lot, he's put on a lot of weight across his first 5-6 years. I guess 8 years now in the league.
Well, 8 years since he was drafted.
8 years since he was drafted. But yeah, but I mean, I remember I mic'd him up in Chicago the day before he was drafted for, like, one of those interviews with our hockey operations staff. And I was just like, oh my God, this guy is so skinny.
Mm-hmm.
He is a much larger human being. So he has put in the work to flesh out an NHL sort of frame. But his play strength isn't there. And I think that's what they're getting at. And mm-hmm. I think that's what they're getting at when they describe JT Miller as a shutdown guy, too, which is also hilarious, right? I mean, absolutely not a top shutdown guy in this league. But he can definitely do the job. And he did an excellent job against McDavid in the Stanley Cup playoffs last year. It's just that, how did he do it? Well, he water skied on him through the neutral zone every time and got away with it consistently. And he was actually dialed in throughout that series in a way that his engagement level kind of ebbs and flows if you're really watching it over the course of a season, right? I don't buy that JT Miller's a plus defensive player. Well, I think he's a good defensive player, but I don't think he's a plus defensive center. I don't buy that Pettersson's a plus defensive center either, to be totally honest with you, at this stage of his career. I think they're both, like, fine. But the gap is that physically, below the hash marks,
mm-hmm.
you have confidence, or a coach would have confidence in Miller being able to hold up, protect the puck in those minutes without being overwhelmed physically. And that's why Miller has played a matchup role under every coach that he's been through in Vancouver. Whereas you have doubts with Pettersson, and that's why he hasn't been. And that's the gap. Like, you have to be able to look at usage. You can't just be looking at underlying form and being like, well, one guy's good defensively, one guy's not. It's like, okay, well, then why does every coach that has the option of deploying both of them against tough minutes versus not tough minutes elect to go with JT? You have to be able to question your own data-based judgment based on the decision-making and commentary of people in the league. Like, they're not stupid people.
My point is less so about, like, a defense of Elias Pettersson's two-way game than it is just that it was a new diagnosis, right? Because even you listen to Rick Tocchet, and what's his focus has been so much on what Pettersson's doing in the offensive zone. You know what I mean? Changing his shot more, being more aggressive with his shot, playing more north-south to get more opportunities, moving his feet, of course, getting to the inside, all of those things. Tocchet has seemed really locked in on the offensive side and how Elias Pettersson can be a more productive offensive player. So I thought it was notable that Rutherford Clifford kind of lodged this new entry into what's wrong with Elias Pettersson, which is focusing on his two-way game. And I like, of course, I mean, we all watched him this year, right? We know he needs to get stronger. We know there's more impact he can make on both ends of the ice. It's just number one, like it doesn't matter if he's not putting up a point per game or something awfully close to it, right? If he does get a little stronger, it's not going to matter. So I was surprised by that, but I guess just again, throw it kind of on the pile of what management thinks Elias Pettersson needs to improve going into next season. Now, you said that everything you heard about Rick Tocchet today made you think it's more likely that Rick Tocchet is back with the Canucks as head coach next year. We'll see how that plays out. Did your assessment of the likelihood of an Elias Pettersson trade change at all based on the commentary from Patrick Alvin and Jim Rutherford?
No, because I think we had to know that it was at least
a possibility
that the club would have to consider based on the fact that they considered it this season.
And Jim Rutherford implicitly reiterated that they considered it in season.
Yes.
Yeah. So like not trying to hide it. All options were on the table, guys, when we were talking about the rift.
I can't even blame anybody for it. I would rather be the team acquiring Elias Pettersson at a sell low cost and gambling on a bounce back than I would be the team trading him in those circumstances. I want to be very clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also come out of today's availability and the tenor of it, the questions from media, the fact that those questions, I think, reflect the attitude of the fan base. Not everybody in the fan base. There's going to be some people who are mad at me for even saying it, just like there's people who are mad at us anytime we criticize Pettersson or what have you. People have been mad at us for years for criticizing JT Miller, too. Like, on and on. Obviously, people are attached to this player in this market, and that's great. But a lot of people are deeply critical, like, really to a point of it being distracting. And I do just, you do kind of reach a point sometimes in relationships between teams and players where the partnership isn't functional and it's hard to sell to the fan base, and it becomes, you know, like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's got its own negative momentum to it. I don't know if we're there yet with Pettersson, but coming out of today, I kind of think we might be. It's like there's so much going on around this team, and what percentage of the questions that they feel that Rutherford and Alvin fielded were either about Pettersson directly or tangentially related to him. 40%.
Yep.
You know, something like 8 of 18, something like that. Like, it was a lot of oxygen on one struggling player.
Mm-hmm.
And the rift that he had with the other player that you had to trade that altered the direction of your franchise. I mean, you do reach a point where there's too much water under the bridge. Again, I'm not saying I think the Canucks are there, but if they're not there, we can at least see it from where we're standing.
It wouldn't shock anybody if they came to the conclusion that they were there. Right? Like, if internally they were like, you know what, I just don't think it's happening. Like,
would you be result? Critical of them if they reach that conclusion?
I don't know how you could be, honestly.
It depends on the price, I guess.
Sure. But like, based just on what we know from the outside, and you have to assume there's a lot more going on behind the scenes that we're not privy to, it would be very difficult for me to look and be like, what are they talking about? He was obviously going to rebound. He might rebound, but it's not obvious. And it's not so obvious to me that you can bank on it happening here, right? And again, that's not me saying, therefore, they should trade Elias Pettersson. I'm just saying, with the information we have, I don't think you could be shocked if management came to the conclusion that there's too much scar tissue, that it's just not going to happen here. We brought up this question on Friday, right? The fundamental question here is, can there be a productive partnership between Elias Pettersson and the Vancouver Canucks? And it is very much a question. And I think whatever way you lean, you can probably see the other side of the answer.
I will say this, okay? If you were considering cutting your losses on Elias Pettersson, would you be criticizing his work ethic behind
as
the
much
scenes?
As much
and
as
his
you
preparation.
Are. I don't know.
To me, that is the canary in the coal mine that suggests that they stick with him and give him another shot.
Right.
Because what's the purpose? Like, what's the purpose of challenging a player publicly if you're Canucks management? It's to get more
cathartic.
From him.
Feels good?
No, they're not bruv and you. It's to fire a shot across his bow. It's to help him train with an edge all summer. It's to nurture that chip on his shoulder to try and challenge him to be the player you need him to be, desperately need him to be in the Canucks case. What do you do if you're considering trading a guy? Oh, that, all that dirty laundry can remain very much in-house. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put it in the dryer. We won't put it on clothespins. We are going to protect the asset. We are going to say the right things. We are willing to surprise the fan base. We are maximizing the perceived value of the asset.
Yeah, that's one way to read into it, for sure.
That would be my read coming out of today is, you know, if I was to price it out, right? I would be like, you know, which team is Pedersen on October 1, 2025? I would price it out like minus 150, Vancouver plus 200 elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to say Carolina.
Oh. That's an interesting one.
Okay, the other piece I wanted to get into here before we take a break and talk to Harm on the other side quickly. Actually, you know what? I'll read some text because we're going to have to go to break here in a couple of minutes. And this one came in earlier. Guys, I'm astounded at how low the bar has become for 40. Praise for a couple of days in the gym. Inflated feelings of defensive prowess despite never being in a matchup role at times. His tone being better with the media. What are we doing here? We are ride or die.
Sorry, whose tone is better with the media?
That's saying at times his tone has been better with the media.
Pedersen?
Well, he had that one, right?
Ah, man.
And then it didn't last long.
You could not have had, I think, with very few exceptions, you could not have had a less appealing season managing media pressure than Pedersen.
I agree, but there was that one. He did get a lot of praise for that.
Well,
one.
That just shows you how low the bar is
That's what this texter is saying. The bar has been lowered so much.
So much.
That's the point he's making, right? Okay. And he says, we are ride or die with hope that he figures it out at 11.6. What a brutal position this management group has put themselves in. This one comes in. Zero accountability for management about their bad UFA signings, their approach to the defense in the offseason, or the fact that they had to pay a first to dump a contract and get Marcus Pedersen. They've created this mess themselves with their quick fixes, and now we'll pay with futures again for shortcuts and hope it works.
Yeah,
one thing I'll say about the, like, because I've seen this talking point.
I don't buy the, I mean, I've even done it, but I don't buy the free agent signing whiffs. They were relatively low cost.
But also, could they have included that in their opening statement? Like, hey, we are responsible for this as well, I guess. But as you just pointed out, like, no one asked them about that. No one asked, like, hey, would you have done anything differently in the summer?
I actually thought about it.
You know what I mean?
But I was too interested about the cap.
And that's not a criticism which is of like the media, because there's so many other things going on. Like, it would be, I get, if I was sitting in that room, I wouldn't want to ask about Vincent Desharnais when there's Rick Tocchet and Tom Volander and Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes and Brock Besser and Thatcher Demko and a practice facility. You know what I mean? So after you get through all of those things, would it have been interesting to hear from them, like what they thought about how they handled their defense and like, hey, was that the right approach in retrospect? Sure. But there's just so much else going on that's bigger picture and more immediate and more present than Danton Heinen and Vincent Desharnais and Noah Juulsen.
I mean, when they traded those guys for what they traded those guys for, they admitted that's real time capitulation.
Capitulation. Exactly.
What do they call it in economics where like your choice is obvious based on your actual,
I have no idea,
thing as opposed to what you're saying?
Mm.
It's like the difference, choice evidence or whatever, where you know, you can say one thing but your actions say another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like
isn't it like people also talk about like revealed preferences?
Revealed preference was exactly what I was looking for. Nice. The preference was revealed. They took account. When you send Daniel Sprong down the I-5
for future considerations,
you've admitted responsibility. Now, for me anyway, the criticism needs to be more opportunity cost based than anything else. Like, for me, it's not that they missed on, for me, it's not that they missed on Heinen that they should be criticized for, or where we should focus our criticism. It's the full, and I know we have to go to break, so I'll try and do this quickly, but it's the full accounting of the opportunity cost incurred over the course of the season. So Besser, Suter, Forbert, remaining Canucks past the deadline. What do you want to say? That's 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Two mid-round picks and a late-round pick.
Yep.
Okay. Is that fair?
Yep.
Carson Soucy, you deal him when the team dealt him versus holding him for another year. the way the Ducks did for Brian Dumoulin, the gap between their valuation is, you know, the difference between a second and a third round pick and another prospect. So throw another mid-round pick into the mix as an opportunity cost from this season. There's the fourth that they trade to get out of Tucker Pullman's LTI deal and then never spend the cap space they toll over the course of the season, right? Then there's, like, you part ways with Kuzmenko in the Elias Lindholm trade, and he returns. You know, he's a part of a Morgan Frost-Farabee trade, and then he nets the Philadelphia Flyers a third-round pick, right? You trade Desharnais to get off that deal in the Marcus Pedersen trade, and they trade Desharnais to San Jose for a fifth. Mm-hmm. They get positive value. Even Sprong netted a seventh-round pick. And so you put that all together, and it's like the opportunity cost of this season, not even including like the first round pick from the Rangers dealt for Marcus Pedersen, not even including that. Although we probably should, because Marcus Pedersen, but it's like to be in the position that they are, they basically spent or incurred a full draft class worth of opportunity cost to miss the playoffs. That to me is where management deserves criticism here. If we're going to get into it, it's not, well, they whiffed on a 2-year deal for Danton Heinen.
Mm-hmm. Janpro, from showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between, Janpro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit janpro.ca. Stanley Cup playoffs are underway. It's time for One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. It's time to put on your Toyo tires. Whether you drive a car, light truck, or van, Toyo tires are designed to perform in all kinds of conditions. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Alder Grove. A couple of series with Canadian teams get going tonight. Drancer, what's your one to watch on the schedule tonight?
Well, the one to watch for me tonight is actually a series that got going on Saturday and delivered us the game of the playoffs so far. That was game one, Winnipeg versus St. Louis. Game two tonight, of course, you can watch that on Sportsnet, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time, so that's 4:30 local. Kyle Connor and Mark Scheifele took over that game. And by the way, they took over it about midway through the second. It wasn't just the two goals they manufactured mm-hmm. in the third. Shift after shift, they were getting in on that Blues defense and generating almost at will, ultimately breaking through with the game tying goal and then the game winner with roughly 90 seconds left in game one. The Blues need to find an answer for the Winnipeg Jets top line. Can they do it tonight? That's what I'm going to be watching.
That is One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Alder Grove. Harmon Dial next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And lots of thoughts coming in to the Dunbar Lumber text line. So we can try to get back into some of those later on in the show. Harmon Dial from The Athletic is going to join us in just a moment here. And a couple of things we can get into with Harmon. I mean, obviously, what we heard from Patrick Alvin and Jim Rutherford earlier today at Rogers Arena, what we heard from Rick Tocchet and the players on Friday. And then Harm also last week published a really great piece doing a deep dive on the differences between peak Elias Pettersson and the version of Elias Pettersson we saw this year. And of course, trying to answer a question that a lot of people here in Vancouver have been desperately trying to answer. We good? Yeah. All right. And now joining us from The Athletic, as mentioned, he is Harmon Dial. Harm, thanks for doing this, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We're doing well. So we'll start with the most immediate stuff, which was Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin speaking to the media today. What was your, if you had to put just one, what was your number one takeaway from what you heard from Canucks management today?
Oh, man, there's so many different directions to go to. I think on the Pedersen front, reading between the lines of all their commentary, the one thing that strikes me is you can tell that the Canucks may not love all of Pedersen's qualities, and they seem to have doubts at this juncture about him being the guy on a cup-winning team, but they also seem to have a realistic understanding that they may be too short on high-end centers to give up on all of this talent, right? So Alvin said that they're going to keep all their options open, and Rutherford spoke at length about the specific areas that they really want to see Pettersson grow in, but at the same time, it was telling, for example, to me anyway, that when Ben Kuzma asked a question, he sort of insinuated that the caliber of center they would need to target would be a true top flight 1C. And unprompted, Alvin brought Pettersson up again and sort of said, we believe he still has the talent to be that guy. So I think that's, to me, on the Pettersson file, that's my sort of big interpretation of the situation in his future, is that they clearly see flaws and have some doubts in the player, but they're so short on high end center help, and he's such a talented player and has such a high ceiling that they, in my mind anyway, reading between the lines, I lean towards thinking that they're more likely than not to stick with him and bet on him bouncing back.
Yeah. The amount of qualifications required in their sort of tepid endorsement of Pettersson stands out to me as being especially fascinating there, Harmon. And yet, we were talking about it last segment, and it feels to me like if you're going to be as open about challenging a player and as open as the Canucks were in sort of the areas that he's going to need to improve, to me, that's incongruous with the idea of them actually considering trading him, right? Like, if you're going to trade the guy, you market him a little bit differently than that. This felt far more to me like a challenge to a player that you know you need.
Absolutely, and we should also clarify, I think when Rutherford spoke about Pettersson needing to be a more complete player and playing the right way, and in the sort of idea that they're not worried about him getting the points, it's about, again, being more complete player. I think there may be some confusion in the sense of, well, Pettersson's pretty good defensively. His play without the puck wasn't a problem this year. But I think it's not so much about being a complete player. I think what they meant is, can you win a cup with him as your best forward? And that refers to, in my mind, the areas that they would want to see him improve, being stronger on his feet, developing that obsessive drive to get better and developing the elite on and off ice habits that a player like Quinn Hughes has. Being a little bit harder to play against, being the type of player that come playoff time under you know, high pressure, big moments, do you elevate or do you sort of shrink under the spotlight like Pettersson did during last year's playoffs? Being a go-to leader that inspires your teammates. I think that narrative of Pettersson needing to improve as an all-around player and being a more complete player wasn't necessarily about, oh, he needs to be a better player without the puck. It was more about all-encompassing, can you be the guy on a cup-contending team? And I think that's specifically where they're challenging.
There was a lot of conversation both on Friday and today about the JT Miller situation with Elias Pettersson. And I find it very striking that both when JT Miller's been asked about it, including since leaving the Vancouver Canucks, when Pettersson's been asked about it, the two principals have kind of really tried to downplay it, while everyone else, and especially now with Jim Rutherford, and, you know, we heard from Brock Besser on Friday and Rick Tocchet, everyone else kind of really opening up a little bit about just how big a deal it was. And the thing I found most interesting was, you know, they decided that, okay, it's untenable, and then they were exploring their options, and, you know, ultimately it was JT who's kind of getting a little anxious, so they decided they had to trade him. But do you think we really, like, were we even, as much as we were talking about it all season, right, and especially in, you know, December and January before Miller was traded, does it seem now with what we've heard that we were even underrating a little bit just how big an impact this was having on the team?
Possibly, yeah, and in real time for sure, because when this story was starting to surface, there was still a ton of pushback, especially among the fan base, about how this was a media fabricated kind of story in the classic toxic Vancouver media. And yet when Rutherford made that opening statement about how disappointing the season was, the Pettersson-Miller situation was the first and really only key talking point and topic that he brought up, and also sort of referencing that it wasn't just those two guys, that it seeped into and had an effect on most of the players in that room and how it got personal between those guys. I think it's, to me, it was very striking and notable that was the first and really the only, you know, big topic that Rutherford mentioned in that opening statement when he referred to this down disappointing season.
What did you make of the overall tone? It felt to me pretty straight. Like, we've got some problems. We've got a tall order ahead of us this offseason, and we're not going to sugarcoat it. Do you agree with that assessment, or did you see some sort of, like, hopeful red meat that perhaps I missed?
Well, I think Jim's a straight shooter. I mean, when he first came here, he was very honest, for example, about how they looked at the cap situation, saw a lot of problems, and Jim straight up said, we're not going to be able to fix this team until we resolve some of the cap concerns. And I think this is sort of an extension of that, where Rutherford didn't shy away from the uncertainty and challenges that they're facing on a lot of different fronts right now. With Tockett's future, right? They really want him back. They view him as by far the best coach for this team, and Rutherford gave Tockett a glowing endorsement of his work this season, and yet they have to wait this week to see if Tockett wants to be back, and they're not going to exercise that option and force him to be here if he doesn't have his whole heart in it. Then also on the Willander front, him potentially going back to college for another season, which is really interesting and far from ideal, because in my mind, having watched a lot of Willander tape over the last couple of weeks, he really has nothing to gain from a potential third season in college. The idea of trading for a top six caliber center and how difficult it'll be, and acknowledging how expensive that'll be, and how they'll kind of have to do whatever it takes to get that done. The practice facility, I thought it was funny where Rutherford said, yeah, it'll get done, but I may not even be on Earth by the time it gets done. Like, they're clearly frustrated by that. And then
no kidding.
At the end, big picture, just acknowledging the elephant in the room about Quinn Hughes' future and how there are factors outside of their control. And Rutherford openly referencing that Quinn said before that he wants to play with his brothers. I think Jim especially was very honest and very straightforward, and I think the overall tone was an understanding that there is a lot of uncertainty and challenges that they're going to have to tackle.
One of my other favorite moments from Rutherford during the press conference was, I forget who it was, but somebody asked him, how many forwards do you need to add? And he said, well, you know, I'll just pull a number off the top of my head here, and three. And I feel like there was maybe some there's been some prior consideration to that number. Let's put it that way. I'm not sure it was quite as random as he would have us believe. But it was interesting because, you know, he gives the three. We need three forwards. And he also said, look, if you look at the list out in free agency at centers, we're going to have to do better than that. Suggested that a lot of different assets would be on the table when it comes to acquiring centers. What did you make of the roadmap that he outlined, at least to a little degree, for how this team is going to improve its center position this summer?
It makes sense to me, because after Sam Bennett, and even Sam Bennett, love the player, but how many times has he even crested the 50, 60 point mark? We're not talking about a guy that on a year to year basis is a consistent 70 point or point per game type of guy. It's not as if you inject Sam Bennett into this lineup, and obviously it would help. It would be massive, but you wouldn't solve this team's overall lack of just elite offensive punch and dynamic game-breaking ability. And so, and obviously once you get past Bennett, the list, especially when you consider the overwhelming likelihood that players like, Tavares re-sign in Toronto, Duchesne likely re-signing in Dallas, it's a really thin list. So I agree with this idea that if they want to target, true game-breaking center threat, it probably has to be via the trade market. It's going to be expensive. But I also thought it was really interesting that Rutherford, in framing the situation, noted that it would also be very expensive and costly if they don't address that need.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the stakes with of next season, how Quinn's going to be extension eligible, and that whole idea of sort of having to do whatever it takes, it really makes me wonder, especially in the context of, potential complications in getting Willander signed, it seems to me that they're willing to potentially be bold and dangle some of their top prospects and maybe even draft pick to sort of solve that need for the right player at the right age category, which honestly, if you're going to solve it via the trade market, you're going to have to be prepared to pay up a ton for it.
What did you make of the commentary about a Demko extension?
Really interesting. I wasn't too familiar with the whole Gary Roberts story and how Rutherford had been the one to sort of bet on him after all the uncertainty around that really serious neck injury. And the fact that Rutherford was all those years ago validated by that decision then, it seems to make him more comfortable with the risk of Demko's durability. And it also suggested to me the way Rutherford was framing Demko's altered training regimen since sustaining some of these injuries, that he really believes that maybe him training too hard previously was what led to some of these injuries. Whether that's right or not is a theory, I don't know. But that seems to be a theory that Rutherford at least subscribes to. And it's also fascinating also because it sort of ties into a lot of the Ian Clark storylines at the start of the season when he sort of stepped away from being the on-ice sort of day-to-day goalie coach. I think with that in mind, you know, this organization sounds like they are definitely open to the idea of exploring Demko extension. I still have some reservations about that personally. I'm not convinced that it's as simple as, well, Demko's changed his training and practice style, and so that means he's not going to face any injury risk or concerns moving forward. I also think it's going to be really tricky to identify, like, how do you even determine his fair market value for him, given that 2 years ago he was the second best goaltender on the planet, and yet this past season he wasn't even available for most of the season. And when we saw him, for the most part, he was shaking off a lot of rust, and we're dealing with a ton of injuries that he's dealt with over the last 12 months now. I think it's really complicated. I think it'd be a risky road for the Canucks to go down, but I can also see how they may look at it and go, if we believe he's going to be able to stay healthy and we believe he's going to bounce back, they could see value in, let's get the extension done now before the market continues to ramp up for UFAs with the cap going up. Because the alternative scenario, again, if you believe he's going to stay healthy and bounce back, Thatcher has a great season next year, and then you're trying to negotiate an extension with him, then obviously it would cost presumably quite a bit more than getting it done now, when on his camp's part, there's probably a lot of uncertainty and incentive to get long-term security.
Harm, last week you published a really great piece looking at Elias Pettersson and kind of the drop-off from where he was 14 months ago at the 2024 All-Star break to what we've seen since then. And I encourage our listeners to go check it out. It's a really, really interesting piece. And, you know, obviously you're someone who covers this team on a day-to-day basis, so you've seen every step of this process from Elias Pettersson. Did kind of taking a step back, going back to the beginning and even earlier in his career, and trying to take a full view of everything, did it change how you look at this situation or look at what's happened at all with Elias Pettersson?
Yeah, to me, it was just so striking going back and watching him in previous seasons, really diving into the tape and noting how much more dynamic and explosive of a presence he was. Just the shot, the speed, how dynamic he was as a puck carrier, driving his own entries, rush offense. And it underscored to me how I really believe the biggest reason why he's fallen off this year is how sort of flat and lethargic he's looked in terms of his physical attributes, in terms of the lack of pop in his skating, not having that same level of juice with a shot. And really, that's by far the biggest thing to me as far as him bouncing back. I think the confidence aspect, the him losing some of the swagger in his game, that will sort itself out if he comes to training camp next season and is once again able to be a player that can dynamically transport the puck through the neutral zone. I just saw, like, in watching the tape this year, you consistently saw a player that couldn't separate and get to the inside, get to those dangerous scoring areas, in large part just because his feet, his body wasn't, his movements weren't dynamic enough to get there. And, you know, this is why when I asked Pettersson last Friday about, you know, the drop off in his speed and in his shot velocity, it was a little concerning to me that he didn't seem to have an explanation or theory behind why that's happened. Now, maybe I will give him a bit of the benefit of the doubt, where maybe he believes, you know, some of it was still injury related, and you know, perhaps there was some reservation on his part of not wanting to continually refer to the knee and have the optics from management's perspective of, oh, he's continually making excuses. But I didn't walk away from Pettersson's press conference on Friday with a ton of confidence that, oh, his skating and his shot is 100% going to be back.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't seem curious about it.
Yeah.
It's so wild.
Yeah, that was really, like, even at the end when he was like, it's something that I'll definitely work on, that was the tone and body language was telling where that was very much added, you know, quickly scrambling that in at the end to fit in his answer, because that's the right thing to say, as opposed to, you know, sometimes when you hear players talk, there just was no conviction. There was no, like, weight behind those words or a sense of, okay, this guy really knows what went wrong, why it went wrong, and has a definitive game plan and blueprint to solve it. There was none of that. And it, as much as I believe in his talent, that's why there's still, it's so hard for me with certainty to say, oh, 100% I think he's going to bounce back next year, because I don't even know if he fully realizes or knows why he's experiencing some of these struggles that he is right now.
I want to ask you about the Hughes commentary, because it's going to get a lot of attention, and it should, I suppose, because Quinn Hughes is Quinn Hughes, and he's probably one of the five or six most impactful individual skaters on the planet. But in some ways, I feel like we're going to spend a lot of time, and not just us, the national media, you can see it everywhere on Twitter, talking about this topic. And it's like, shouldn't everything Rutherford have said there have been evident to anyone who's paying attention?
Yes, but I also think it's rare for managers to be that candid and open and just publicly lay all the cards out there. The quote Rutherford had about, we know he said before that he's wanted to play with his brothers. I don't know how much of a narrative, like, yeah, like, we can all put two and two together and sort of figure out that, yeah, it would be pretty appealing to play with your two brothers. But how much of, like, has that really been a concrete thing that Quinn has like publicly said and has flown around as a quote before?
Yes. And at the Athletic.
Yes.
Do you work,
like,
there?
I mean, it's a widespread.
But we'd have to go back and look, because you can always be like, oh, you know, at some point in my career, that would be cool or whatever. You know what I mean? It's different. There's different levels of it. It's a spectrum of saying, I'd like to play with my brothers.
And that was also, like, quite a while ago, right? It's like, put it this way. Like, I've had many conversations just, like, casually with Canucks fans or around this topic of, like, Quinn's future. And it's not like they've been referencing, oh, Quinn said he wants to play with his brothers.
Sure.
We're kind of cooked here. Yes, again, if you put two and two together, you can see that, okay, that's going to be an appealing a possibility. But again, it's the just like saying the quiet part out loud or saying what everybody is thinking just out loud in such a public setting. I think that's why it's gone a lot of play, even though when we sit back and look at the situation, it's not as if anything truly groundbreaking was said.
Mm. Yeah, it feels like one of those where the impact is likely to outstrip the significance. That would sort of be my take on this.
Yeah, that's fair.
That,
I would agree on that.
You know, like, the fact that the Canucks feel pressure to win, given the Quinn Hughes timeline, like, to me, that should be something we can safely assume as adults, as opposed to something we need to hear management say.
Yeah. Well, also, at least at this point now, it's good too. We can openly and honestly, you know, talk about, you know, Quinn's future and the storylines and the urgency to get back on track in order for the organization to have the best possible odds of keeping him without certain segments of the market sort of being like, oh, why are you fear-mongering? Mm. Why are you this and that? Again, that's why it's sort of just Jim saying what everybody has been thinking out loud. It's nice that we can at least have these conversations openly and honestly and understand that this is the reality of the situation, that, yeah, there is a lot of pressure on the organization to figure things out over the next 12 to 18 months.
Harm, always appreciate the time. And again, great job on that article on Elias Pettersson and what's happened with his game. Everyone should go check it out at The Athletic. We'll talk again soon, man.
Thanks.
That is Harmon Dial from The Athletic. By the way, a little bit of breaking news from down I-5. Elliot Friedman reporting that the Seattle Kraken making a coaching change. Dan Bylsma will be let go and a full search will begin. Ron Francis hanging on for dear life there, apparently.
I don't understand how he gets a third coach.
It's a very surprising
one. Especially, I would add, especially because, like, Kaapo Kakko and Matty Beniers found a lot of chemistry really fast in the second half of the season. Like, Beniers ended the season really strong. And Shane Wright, who Bylsma's worked with ever since he turned pro, like 2 years ago in the AHL, had a kind of a breakout season.
Yeah, this was year one for Bylsma.
Yeah.
That's...
And, you come out of the season being like, man, the Kraken are in trouble. But feeling far better about their path to actually having a couple of elite players than you would have before the season. And that's not because they signed Chandler Stephenson.
Yeah.
It's because of sort of what we saw developmentally from Beniers in the second half and Shane Wright throughout the season. To me, that's a credit to Bylsma, at least partly.
1 year with that, like, that man, that is just quick.
Yeah, I don't like that.
That's wild. So we'll see if there's another shoe to drop there in Seattle or not. But right now, Dan Bylsma out.
Coaching, not their issue.
No. And another coaching vacancy opens up in the NHL. So we'll have more on that later this week, I'm sure. But some more meat on the bone that we can continue to chew on from Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. All right. Still digesting everything we heard from Patrick Alvin and Jim Rutherford earlier today about the state of the Canucks, the future direction of the Canucks. And of course, one major topic of conversation was the state of the team's depth chart down the middle at center. And Jim Rutherford, in typical Jim Rutherford fashion, did not shy away at all from acknowledging what an important step that was. And, you know, you heard Harmon Dial reference earlier when we were chatting with him as well. Patrick Alvin did say, like, well, hey, we think PD can be our number one center. But even beyond that, obviously, a desire to improve the center position. And a couple of interesting things that I think are worth digging into a little bit more from Jim Rutherford specifically on that. One was he said, basically, if you're looking to improve your forward group overall, you got to get your centers nailed down first. That was the gist of what he had to say, because then there's a lot of different things you can do at the wing, right? There's a lot of different ways you can go at the wing if you have that really solid spine of the team down the middle that you're trying to improve your forward group. And
well, I think it's more like, so I've been thinking about this a little bit because I've been talking a lot about the dynamics switching with the cap inflation era coming into focus, right? What do teams have to do to operate differently? What will the smartest teams do to adjust in this new world where cap growth is something you can count on as being like a steady factor? And in fact, where effectively like more than 10% cap growth YOY is now locked in through the next 3 years by agreement between the NHL and the NHLPA. And, you know, I've been talking a lot about sort of lessons from the NFL. Right, which has seen $30 million a year cap growth. Now, granted, their cap is in the $200+ million range, so it's not apples to apples necessarily. But nonetheless, I think instructive here. And you know, for me anyway, right? It's like if there's lessons to be drawn from the NFL, who do you look at first?
The Philadelphia Eagles.
The Philadelphia Eagles. Howie Roseman, baby.
Yeah.
And the Eagles do three things that are really the basis of their team building success. One, dominate the trenches, be absolutely dominant both sides of the ball on the defensive line. And I think this is where center, build through the middle, and on defense.
Premium positions. Take care of your premium positions.
We'll get to that because that's lesson two. But so center and defense. In a environment where the cap is going to significantly rise, right? What are you going to get? You're going to get no centerman available in unrestricted free agency. Free agency is going to stop because you have every team's going to have the money to keep their most important players, right? So what's going to happen? Only flawed guys are going to make it to unrestricted free agency. And I suspect we may even see that dynamic play itself out between now and July 1 with Duchesne and Sam Bennett and John Tavares being like three high-end centermen, none of whom are actually on the market come July 1, right? Like, that's my strong expectation at this point, frankly.
Yeah. Or if John Tavares is, it's like in name only, right? Because Toronto or bust.
Yeah, he's not going to make it there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, free agency is going to become an unreliable source of addressing those premium positions. So you're going to have to pay massive premiums to acquire those players or draft and develop them yourselves. But dominate in the trenches is the Howie Roseman rule. And in hockey, build through the middle, have a strong defense core. That's going to be the equivalent. The other thing the Eagles are really disciplined about doing is they draft only premium positions early in the draft. They only spend draft capital on offensive linemen and defensive linemen and edges and wide receivers, right? Like the guys that cost a ton of money in unrestricted free agency or don't make it to unrestricted free agency at all. Now, in the NFL, it's a little different. These guys are basically ready-made when you draft them.
Yeah.
But the point is you draft a running back in free agency, even if they're a great player, like an electric, top-of-the-league, all-pro level player. The truth is that your surplus value provided is low because you can still go out and sign Saquon Barkley for $12 million, which is a third of what a top wide receiver makes, a third of what a top, you know, offensive tackle makes, et cetera, et cetera. I think the hockey equivalent to this, right, is to specifically target in the draft only guys with either the tools or production to be top of the lineup players. Like, do not worry about landing a guy who could be a third line center if everything hits, because the truth is that your upcoming third line center is going to be a failed first rounder, right? You're able to go out and sign Teddy Bluegers. You're able to go out and sign Pius Suitors. You're able to go out and find Kiefer Sherwood on the free agent scrap heap, right? You can find a third pair defenseman. You can sign a Derek Forbert. Like, do not go drafting. Do not think about drafting a guy because you think he could become Derek Forbert for you. You can sign Derek Forbert, and it's not going to cost that much.
I might go even further with that lesson in the draft, which would be to focus on even more on guys you think have the chance to be play drivers rather than complimentary top of the lineup players.
Yeah, right. Like, exactly right.
Where if this hits, not just is he a winger we feel good about who can complement a top line center, but he's someone who can drive play for us if he hits. And we're willing to take on a little bit more risk that maybe he doesn't hit because of that outcome. Because I think that's kind of what Rutherford was getting at with the, well, strengthen your center, and then there's a lot of things you can do with the wing, right? Like,
right.
Once you have your play drivers, then you can fit the pieces around them. And this gets back to a conversation we were having about Brock Besser, is can you afford to lock in at market value a complementary player when you don't have your play drivers, the pieces they're supposed to complement, already established around them?
Right.
And so I think even, like, you're right, like, don't draft someone who you think it's like, well, hey, they were a really good defensive player in junior, they're going to be our third line center. Draft someone with a chance to be a higher up the lineup piece. But I would say even more than that, like, was finishing their best skill? Like, okay, finishing's nice, but that's also probably a complementary skill at right. the NHL level, right? Like, focus in on those guys who can carry the mail and drive a line.
Yeah, and have rare traits. Like, yeah. Elias Pettersson gets drafted, and people are like, well, he's a stay-at-home defenseman. Maybe he's tops out as a third pair. But it's like, yeah, but if he's going to be an absolute brick house who can hit and can move, and you're telling me that if you can get 5% more out of his puck skill, I'm going to be dropping Ekholm comparisons in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very, very cool. Like, that is awesome. So, another example, Vilmer Ulriksson, right? At the end of the day, if you're 6'7" and can move and have some deceptive puck skill, even if your ability to manipulate defenders is like a little bit hit and miss, it's like, if he can graft some consistency onto his offensive toolkit, I mean, the physical toolkit is through the roof, right? Like, those are the types of picks I want to see this team swing at, as opposed to, like, guy who's already been in college for 2 years, but you really like his work rate.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, you're just burning, you're drafting a running back round one. That's the equivalent. And then the last thing, and I think this is a really critical one, is pay guys early. Pay guys early. The moment you're extension eligible for the Eagles, like they did Cam Jurgens today,
mm-hmm.
That you get signed. If you're good, we're going to sign you. We'll figure out the rest later. And we're going to sign you long term. And we're going to sign you at pretty good money. And the thing about it is, in a world where the cap keeps going up, 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 the market keeps getting reset for these guys. So don't wait. Do not wait. Sign guys long, sign guys early. Right. And in this sort of lens, like, Hoglander had a disappointing season after signing an extension. Who cares? Hoglander at $3 million for the next four or five years.
3 years, I believe.
Perfect. Yeah. The only problem with that is it's not long enough. Like, that's exactly the sort of deal you should be doing. Even if it's a loser, it's a winner in a world where the cap is going to go up this much. Another one is, like, you know who, even after a really tough campaign, would be paid more than the Canucks paid him last year? Dakota Joshua. If Dakota Joshua was headed for unrestricted free agency, I think his valuation would exceed what they paid. Even after the year that he just underwent.
Maybe.
100%.
It wouldn't be a massive drop.
Lock. Lock. Absolute lock. Stone cold lock. Every team would look at it and be like, man, this guy never got caught up after cancer diagnosis surgery.
Yeah.
And then he had another injury in January. He's such a rare player type. We are happy to gamble on a player like this. Everyone, every team in the league, he would crush that number. And so, you know, I think those are the Eagles rules applied to hockey. Draft only for star upside. And boy, you should really be making more picks like that, because if you can land a lot of your picks are going to end up being Danila Klimovic, but you land one or two Elias Petterssons here and there, and man, it changes the whole complexion of what you are, which is why I'll never stop talking about amassing draft capital. It matters way too much to be able to, honestly, like, it's too bad that they lost Fernstrom and then he immediately blew up, but that's like a perfect example of exactly the sort of value you need to be trying to bring in to your organization. You know, I think the Carolina Hurricanes are a phenomenally interesting example too, where, you know, you've got these guys, like all these guys, like Jackson Blake was a fourth round pick for them. He led their team in ice time in game one of the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Morrow, like, they're in a position with Orlov and Burns expiring where they kind of have to let them walk, because you need to open up minutes for Morrow and Nikishin, two guys they drafted after like in the late third round or fourth round, or sorry, Morrow was a first, right?
Morrow might have been a second. Yeah.
Second. But after the first round, those guys are tracking in such a way where like far from being like, well, we'll let these guys walk and then we have to really fret about replacing them. It's like, no, you actually need to be conscious to not replace them. You need to have the self-confidence not to replace them because you make so many picks every year and you hit just frequently enough that you need to open up minutes for that next group of guys. That's where you need to get to.
Now, the other part of Rutherford's commentary about the center position was, again, yes, costly to acquire, but just as costly not to acquire, right? Very much mindful of the opportunity cost, especially when you view it through the Quinn Hughes lens of being too shy to pay the acquisition cost for a real difference maker at center. And he did say, look, it depends on how good a player we're getting back, but very much did not take this year's first round pick, which pending a miraculous lottery win will be 15th overall, did not take that off the table. And, you know, yes, there was one moment where he gave the organization credit for rebuilding the pipeline and said, you know, look at these young players and the guys that came up and what Abbotsford is doing, but also very much didn't take trading any of their young assets off the table either for a potential center acquisition. So overall, and this again should not be any surprise when we're talking about Jim Rutherford and the reporting you've done about how the team views this summer and others have done, of course, but very much an aggressive mindset, a publicly aggressive mindset that we know just how important it is to go out and acquire specifically a difference-making center, and we're not shy about the price it's going to cost to do that.
Frank Saravalli, by the way, just tweeted out, in addition to a head coaching change with Dan Bylsma fired, there is no shortage of speculation in league circles that Kraken general manager Ron Francis will move to another front office position, and assistant general manager Jason Botterill, a longtime Rutherford lieutenant in Pittsburgh, will be promoted to general manager. He adds, we'll see. So,
and I will say there's also like Arthur Staple, your colleague at the Athletic, saying hearing there will also be a change in the Seattle front office. Jason Botterill, new GM, Ron Francis will be team president. I think EJ Raddick from ESPN reporting something similar as well. So Frank, not necessarily pressing the brakes, but just not reporting it either. Some other people reporting it. We'll see if this change does come to fruition, what exactly it looks like. But as you said, yeah, lots of reporting out there that Ron Francis will be promoted, actually, as a result of how he's handled the Kraken so far. And Jason Botterill will take over as the new general manager there.
Promoted.
Who is? Oh, okay, so Ron Francis will be addressing the media in Seattle tomorrow at 1, okay, according to our producer, Lena Stanley.
And then we'll have some clarity.
So we should have some clarity there. Interesting.
Yeah. Man. Anyway, just wanted to update that since we'd sort of gone through it. One thing that we really didn't hear the organization get too much into today was Pugh Suter. They were full of praise for Pugh Suter. But Pugh Suter's unrestricted free agent status and Brock Besser's, it was kind of like tangentially.
It was total back burner. It was only like indirectly asked about even.
Yeah, well, there was too much fish to fry.
There was no like, let's go back and relitigate the trade deadline. There was no like, hey, have you talked to Brock or anything like that? It was more just, you might lose them. And then them saying like, yeah, but we might not. That was pretty much the extent of the conversation about those two players.
Yeah.
Which was remarkable. And as you say, it's just there's so much else going on. But yeah, Brock Besser's pending unrestricted free agency barely talked about at this media availability, which is pretty stunning when you consider his position on this team and how much he's done for this team.
I think the unrestricted free agent market is about to go completely loco. And I think we're not really prepared for the level of sticker shock that we're all going to have on July 1 and what it means. I think contractual analysis this year is going to be as difficult as it's ever been. I am very prepared to look silly myself and also to dunk on other silly takes that are then better than my own, which, you know, happens.
We'll see. We're entering a brave new world for sure.
We are entering. And so I'll be fascinated to see how this all plays out. I think the club has long believed that all of Pugh Suter, Derek Forbert, and Brock Besser would prefer to remain in Vancouver, all things being equal, but all things will not be equal. The Canucks only have so much buying power. They have, you know, I think, thrown the gauntlet down in terms of how aggressive they want to be this offseason. I just saw you responded to a text from Justin in East Van who said, anytime I hear about an aggressive Canucks offseason, I'm reminded of Jim Benning trading for OEL. And by the way, I think it's totally fair if the hairs on the back of your neck, I don't have any, but if the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you hear that the Canucks are like going to go all in this offseason. But make no mistake, they are going to go all in.
They're going to try.
And
there has to be the right player out there, but they're going to try.
And this is, again, where there is a responsible way to go all in, and there is an irresponsible way to go all in. I do think, however, that to not swing big this offseason would also be, to Jim Rutherford's, it's also costly to not land top center, would also be an irresponsible move. Like, I think Quinn Hughes is a top five or six skater in the league right now. You have to do everything possible to credibly protect that investment. Everything possible. And that means building a team that at least has a shot to be credibly presented as a contender a year from now.
Really quickly, Jim Rutherford acknowledging that it might happen after he's departed this earth, but he is going to get a practice facility built for the Vancouver Canucks. Another standout moment from Jim Rutherford. Quick reaction to his commentary on the practice facility.
I really thought what was interesting was him going into specifically how the club has struggled on this end, right? That they've tried three or four different facilities.
How frustrating the process has been.
And it didn't work out. The idea that, like, partnering with other rinks is what's required here, as opposed to building your own designated practice facility. Like, if you show up to local rinks, local facilities with significant capex and a partnership with the Vancouver Canucks, you can move heaven and earth.
Mm-hmm.
I know, because I worked through it with the municipality of Fort Lauderdale when we had exactly that situation, and it was incredible what we were able to achieve in terms of getting an Art Deco War Memorial building to redesign.
Yeah.
If you show up without CapEx and are willing to do a smaller amount of investment, and really what you're hawking is a partnership with the Vancouver Canucks, that's still valuable, but it's much less valuable, much easier for teams to be like, well, that partnership, or not teams, organizations to be like, that partnership doesn't go far enough for us with where we're at. And I that's what I read into the commentary.
And then there was also the follow-up that they're looking, I think, three or four parcels of land, or two or three maybe, that, and they're going to build a new facility. That's what he said, at least the track they're on. Well, it's buying a parcel of land and trying to build their own facility.
And they have to. I mean, you know, whether it was the Plaza of Nations, SFU, UBC, all of these places have been reported as places that the Canucks have been in talks with. But if you build a rink and you own it and you operate it and you don't have to pay HRR off of it and you can use it to be a leader in community hockey in Vancouver, one of the great hotbeds of talent development in the mm-hmm. world right now. I mean, that's just good business and good public-facing stewardship. Two areas where, you know, I think the organization, frankly, hasn't done enough to prioritize across a generation now.
All right, that's the show for today. GM Patrick Alvin will be doing an exclusive interview with Canucks Central Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah, so tune in for that at 4, and we'll be back tomorrow for more Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650.